The title is clunky, but the wine talk is smooth. You're listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast.
Hey, everyone, and welcome to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. My next guest, one of the more famous guests I've ever had on, and it is Bob Bloomer, who is an 8-time Guinness Book World Record holder. I don't know why that one always comes to mind first. Author of so many books, TV. He's in town for breakfast television. Bob, I feel like if I was going to do a full bio of you, I'd have to then say goodbye and end the interview. So I really appreciate you doing this.
It's a pleasure.
Happy to talk about stuff.
What does it mean? Actually, let's just start here. What was your morning today? What we're recording this on July 29th. It is a very sweaty day. What was your morning like today?
Well, I came into town to help launch Wild Blueberry Month. So I was I did a little appearance on breakfast television, making Wild Blueberry Sangria and some marinated chicken thighs with a Wild Blueberry salsa.
And how'd that go?
It was fun. Always yeah. Fun to, it always gets the heart pounding, gets you up in the morning when you're doing live television.
What is the misconception about sangria? Because I'm always nervous. There seems to be like a wide range. Some of it's so great, but a lot of restaurants, it feels like they just need to have it on the menu and it's almost an afterthought. They don't put any time and attention into it.
Sangria to a cocktail is the equivalent of gazpacho to soup. There's such a range of how much attention and how many flavors you can build into sangria. And the same is true with the gazpacho. You can go to a restaurant and have a gazpacho and it seems like it's basically some tomato juice that's blended up with some celery and some celery salt and green bell pepper and a bit of onion and that's it. Or you can go to another restaurant where they've created like layers of flavor and texture. I'm saying all of this because I have a gazpacho that I love to make, which starts with bread and almonds and garlic, and you create this base upon which you build and build and build and build, and then you finish it off with some bright acid, some lemon juice, some balsamic vinegar, which is not a bright acid. But anyways, so the same like spectrum exists in the world of sangria, and someone can either take a ton of care and be really proud of it, or just dump a few things into a pitcher and. That's why.
It's such range.
That was a really long-winded digression.
Well, that's okay. I didn't know we were going to go. I was now going to ask you, all right, follow up. What's the best wine? What would you pair with a nice gazpacho? And it doesn't have to be wine. It could be a cocktail or a beer.
Sure, sure, sure. But as you know, you can get there from here so many different ways. One of the things I love about pairing wines, and to me, that is like kind of the ultimate. Like you can have wine, you can have food, but pairing wines that really work is my favorite thing. And when you have a little bite of something and you take a sip of something and there's that harmonious thing going on in your mouth, that's when you know it's succeeded. But you can get there from here. So you can, as you know, you can have a bright acidic wine that can match the acids, or you can have a fatter wine that is a sort of counterpoint to the gazpacho. And so in answer to your question, at home I have some big Chardonnays. That's what I'll serve. But that's just because what I have. Mm-hmm. You can't really go wrong, I don't think, with a gazpacho. What would you serve?
Actually, it's funny you mentioned Chardonnay. That's exactly where I was going to go as well. But I'm a very pro Chardonnay person. So yes, I want that nice round Chardonnay to go with my gazpacho. You know what? I'm doing this interview all wrong. I'm a bad interviewer. I should start from the top because I'm assuming everyone knows who you are, because when I was telling my girlfriend I was interviewing you, she's like, oh, I was on a show with him years ago. He had this Toastmobile, and me and my twin sister, Christy, we were, and they've done a bunch of TV here and there, and they know you. And there's a lot of other people, when I say Bob Bloomer, they're like, oh my God. But there's other people that maybe don't watch a lot of cooking shows or read a lot of books like that. I was wondering if you could explain to people, I don't know, maybe it's through, what does it mean to be a professional gastronaut, but how would you describe Bob Bloomer to someone who doesn't know?
I took a very circuitous path to get to where I landed. So I went to business school Then I managed an eclectic Canadian singer-songwriter by the name of Jane Sibbery, who mm-hmm. you might have heard of, best known for a song called Mimi on the Beach. That was a big, much music hit in the 80s. Then on a whim, while I was still managing Jane, I wrote a cookbook, or I wrote a proposal for a cookbook, or I just had this crazy idea to create a cookbook, even though I'd never owned one nor taken a cooking class in my life. And I managed to trick Chronicle Books in San Francisco into publishing it. And then it came out, and I was immediately reviewed by the New York Times and invited on to the Today Show, at which point I realized that I better learn how to cook.
Really?
And then, it's a true story. And then I just started hanging out with chefs and somms and winemakers. And 34 years later, I've kind of learned, you know, you hear about people in the food world who, chefs who, I mean, accomplished chefs who started off as dishwashers and just went up through the kitchen system.
Right. Yeah.
Then there's people who go to culinary school, and there's other people who do it differently. But I just did it from hanging out with a lot of chefs and ultimately eating my way around the world. And then when I did my, so I had a show called Surreal Gourmet, which was an instructional cooking show in an Airstream trailer with 2 8-foot slices of toast on top, because the Airstreams all looked like vintage toasters to me.
Yeah.
And then I had another show called Glutton for Punishment during, so in every episode I'd have 5 days to learn a particularly daunting, physically challenging food related skill. And then on the 50, I'd be thrown to the wolves and have to enter a professional competition or rise to the occasion of a challenge. But in that case, it was like getting a mini PhD in whatever it was, be it oyster shucking or catfish noodling or pie baking or whatever. And so after I did 58 episodes of that, like, that was a real education unto itself. There's nobody who goes to chef school gets the broad range of skills, like learns this broad range of skills that I was able to learn because of these episodes and working with mentors who were the best in their fields. And so that's how I learned.
What was the hardest punishment? Was there one that really stuck out for you? And what's catfish noodling? That sounds disgusting.
Well, catfish noodling is really cool because it's, you know, I don't know if you've ever gone out deep sea fishing, but these people go out deep sea fishing and they're out in these huge boats and these huge reels and rigs, and there's like gaffer taped into their seats, and there's, you know, crew hands running around with big gaffs to get the fish. And there's not really a lot of sport involved, if you ask me. I mean, I'm sure somebody could argue that there is, but I don't think there is. And then on the other end of the spectrum, there's like fly fishing, you know, where you're wading in the water, and at least the trout has a chance.
Yeah, exactly. It's not all this technology.
No.
Yeah.
It's sort of mano a mano. And then there's catfish noodling, where these guys, mostly in middle America, go wade in these often man-made or these really shallow lakes, and where there's, say, a concrete jetty, often catfish will lay their eggs underneath these concrete sort of outlying chunks of concrete, and the catfish will, the female lays its eggs, and then the male hovers over the eggs to protect them. Mm-hmm. And catfish noodlers will put their hand,
Totally interrupt for half a second. And there's one mosquito where we were doing this. Nice job, Susan. All right.
So the catfish noodler, the fisher person, puts their hand in the water where they can't see it, but they think there might be a catfish. And if the catfish sees the hand to protect the eggs, it will strike the hand. Now, if you or I had, in any normal situation, had a 15-pound catfish striking your hand, you would immediately pull it away.
Yes.
But a catfish noodler jams it into the fish's mouth, grabs it by the jaw, and pulls the fish out from underneath this, wherever it's hovering, with his or her bare hands. And that's when the fish really has a fighting chance. And to me, that's sport fishing.
Okay, so what I love about this is, for Glutton for Punishment, that's a lot of range. So one of the episodes, you've got a large fish striking you, and the other one, you're making pies. That's a lot of range for different shows. What does it mean to be a professional gastronaut?
It's funny, because I have had this sort of unusual education as a chef, I hesitate to use the word chef because I'm not formally trained. And there was a point at which, I can't remember, you know what things are like these days on the interweb, and people feel free to comment and whatever about anything they want to, which is fair game. But someone was taking me to task for calling myself a chef, which I don't really do, but sometimes chefs will call me chefs, and then I'll repeat that and say, you know, whatever. Anyways, I got to a certain point, end of the story, got to a certain point, like, I didn't want to have to justify to anybody whether I was or wasn't a chef. I know personally, I'd rather have me cook a meal for myself than some kid who just got out of like a 10-month culinary program and is working at the Holiday Inn, who's technically a chef. Mm-hmm. So I just said, you know what, to hell with it, and I'll be a gastronaut. Because I do. I cook and I travel around the world and eat, and so.
It's funny, there's definitely a parallel between that and in the sommelier world, where what defines if you're a sommelier, and some people say you have to be working on the floor every day, and people debate and argue it, and I think for you, at some point, you just got tired of having to say, well, no, actually, I'm not a true chef, because I haven't done that, but wait, I have done cooking all these years, I have these books. At some point, it takes too long. It's like, fine, yes, I'm a chef.
Yeah, because sure. I mean, you're in the middle of a lake, and or say the ocean, and you're drowning, and there's a big burly surfer, and then there's also the 16-year-old skinny kid who just got his lifeguard, you know, certification.
Yeah,
like, who do you want to rescue you?
I want the burly surfer exactly. to rescue me. So, yeah, not someone who just watched a couple episodes of Baywatch and took some courses.
Exactly.
Yeah. You know what? We'll get to the role of wine, what it plays in a good meal, in a little bit. Because I feel that's going to be the heart of this. I was going through it. Do you have a favorite of all your different Guinness records that you broke? I don't know why. I always, maybe because as a kid, I always read the Guinness Book of Records. Because I was born in 1975. So in 1984, that was like the height of entertainment. And there's the onions, the Caesar salads, the eggs cracking, the pancakes being made, which is a fun video. Do you have a most memorable of all your Guinness Book of Records that you broke?
The first record I attempted to break for my show Glutton for Punishment was the pancake record. And that was super exciting because there was a ton of pressure, and it was at the Calgary Stampede. And it was this whole idea of breaking a record was new. And it was the most pancakes made in an hour, and it's, you have to drop them on the griddles. They have to be a particular size. You can't use one of those dropping machines, mm-hmm. Or whatever that measures out the exact amount. And there was a Guinness adjudicator there to measure out each pancake and make sure it qualified. And so I had an hour to do this. I think I got off to a slow start. And so people were doing the math in their heads, trying to figure out if it was even, you know, possible at all. And in the end, I managed to break the record by, I don't know, 10 or 20 pancakes. I think the number was 600 and something, maybe 614 or whatever. So I was able to eclipse the former record by 10 pancakes, which was like basically by the skin of my teeth.
Yeah.
But that was a big deal.
Yeah.
And then it was super fun. And then we said to the Food Network, let's do some more. And they said, no, you can't do more. And then a year later, they came back to us and said, we've got this great idea.
Oh, no.
Why don't you do a whole season of trying to break Guinness World Records? And so then we did them. And then I was terrified. It was actually a half season. So we attempted to break, we did six episodes. And I had nightmares forever thinking, like before the season started, thinking, what happens if I get totally shut out? This will be humiliating.
Yeah.
But I ended up going 6 or 6 because I am a... Am I allowed to swear on this?
Yes, you can.
I am one pig-headed motherfucker. And when I decide to do something and put my mind to it, I'm pretty tenacious.
I think I like this one. Most individual grains of rice picked with a pair of chopsticks in 3 minutes. That one sounds like that would be infuriating.
There's a lot of different records, some of which are so crazy because the volume is so huge. You know, you need like a village and a corporation behind you. And then this was a very small undertaking, which was I had a bowl of rice and I had a pair of chopsticks and I had to pick up the rice grains one at a time. And it's really about dexterity. And mm-hmm. you had to pick them up and put them in your mouth like this, one at a time. And there's two judges leaning over me, making sure there's not two grains of rice getting picked up in one thing of chopsticks. Yeah, it was fun. But that's right in my wheelhouse. Mm-hmm. If I am anything, I am dexterous. I'm not strong, I'm not smart, but I'm dexterous.
And our wonderful host, Susan, bringing blueberries and muffins.
Wild blueberries.
Okay. You know what? You were doing breakfast television here because of blueberry season. Wax poetic. Explain to people why the wild blueberry is just such an important part of the fruit world.
Well, wild blueberries are North America's indigenous fruit. They do go way back. And wild non-cultivated blueberries are tiny. That means that the ratio of skin to pulp is much higher, and all the antioxidants in blueberries are in the skin. And so, just simply stated, they're sweeter, tastier, healthier.
I have your first book here, The Surreal Gourmet, Real Food for Pretend Chefs. It's a great title. What do you remember back in these days when you were just trying to fake it, when you were writing your first book?
I wrote that book in a complete vacuum. I knew nothing about cooking. I had just proposed this cookbook to Chronicle Books. And the truth is, the real backstory to this book is when my kid sister moved into her first apartment, I cobbled together a scrapbook in which I put the six recipes I knew how to make, and then all these tips for surviving in your own first apartment.
Right.
So, you know, how to stock a fridge, which really meant like a six pack of beer in case anyone came to visit her, and you know, some eggs and whatever else. And then when I had this idea to write an actual book, I just took that concept of like, how to get more out of life regardless of what your lot in life is. And I couldn't afford a photographer, so I illustrated it with my own surreal illustrations, which is why I called myself The Surreal Gourmet. And what makes this book distinctive is that it really is a guide to better living. It's not so much about the recipes. And I had an album to cook by, a sort of thematically connected album to cook by for every meal. And if you couldn't get out of the kitchen in less time than it took to play an LP back in those days,
yep,
about 40 minutes, then you were spending too much time in the kitchen. So there were a lot of whimsical things in retrospect when I look back at it that made that book successful, the least of which were the recipes at the time.
I do see recipes for, there was margaritas and martinis. I just took a quick peek and I went to the cocktail section. All right, totally off topic. You were talking about just more.
I'm not sure how we can go off topic on your show, Matt, because I'm not sure there is a topic.
I could show you. I actually have like a full list of questions, but then I just saw this other. You're talking about like wellness and how that was more important for your book than maybe the recipes. Could you go into someone's kitchen, look in their cupboards and their fridge, and have like an idea of who this person is or what their life is? Like, how much could you glean?
Oh, totally. I can do that at the grocery store, mm-hmm, when I'm behind them in line at the checkout. You can see what they focus on, and if they're buying, you know, if they're buying food from the frozen section, maybe they don't have time to cook. They're not interested in cooking. Depending on what fruits and vegetables they have and spices and things like that, you get a sense of how into it they are. You can definitely. And then there's people who, you know, just go through with a six pack. Well, I live in California, so you can buy booze of all sorts,
yes,
of all kinds in the grocery store. So, you know, there's like the six pack and the bag of chips and the cigarettes. And
oh, yeah. All right. Let's go to, you know, one of the main reasons I wanted to have you on, and then we'll talk about your latest book, Flavor Bomb, A Rogue Guide to Making Everything Taste Better. But for you, what role does wine play in a good meal?
Wine continues to play a bigger and bigger role in my life. I love it. It's sort of when you get to, you know, your later phases in life, for me, it's about vice management. So I've managed to eliminate every other vice in my life, except for wine. Mm-hmm. Which I truly love. And I think it's also one of those things that the more you taste, the more perspective you have on any bottle that you're drinking, because you have that many hundreds or thousands of bottles of wine that you've tasted before it to judge it against. So it really makes me appreciate it more and more now. The more I drink, the more I can, right, appreciate it, because I have more perspective. And I've had some pretty incredible experiences in the wine world, mostly that I've manifested because I'm so into wine. Probably the highlight of my life was living on the property and picking grapes at DRC, Domaine de la Romanée-Conte, for the entire 1999 harvest.
Really?
With Aubert de Villain in you know, on the property the whole time.
How did you get on? How did you get on that property in 1999?
In 1998, I was in Burgundy for Les Grands Jours de Bourgogne. I was invited to participate in this professional wine event. I wasn't a professional, but I was. The best way to describe it was back in those days when I had some books out, and I was a young punk. I would have been the modern day equivalent of an influencer. So I was invited to some interesting things. So I was invited to go to Burgundy for a week, drove around with a guy whose name, was it Frank Pryle or was it the, I think it was the person, who was the person, Terry Robards, sorry. Frank Pryle succeeded him at the New York Times as the wine writer, but Terry Robards was the original wine writer at the New York Times. In fact, if I'm not mistaken, I have it in the back of my head that he might have been a sports writer, and then someone said, oh, you know a little bit about wine, do you want to write? And he ended up writing for whatever, 10 years. And so we drove around and tasted a lot of Burgundies. One day we went past DRC because they were harvesting, and I was sort of introduced to the foreman, and I said, geez, I'd love to come and pick for a day. And he went like, ah, pick for a day, I spit on you. And no one, you know, not really, but you know, no one picks for a day. If you're interested in picking and you want to commit to a whole harvest, well, hey, send me a note and we'll think about it. So I did, and I followed up, and I got a letter saying, we are inviting you to be a grape picker. Please be prepared to arrive in Von Romane anytime between September 1st and September 20th, which is sort of hard when you're living in California. But
it's the harvest, you know, yeah.
And I went, and I picked grapes and was totally humiliated by spindly little 80-year-old French grandmothers who were picking like five times as fast as I was down the line. But it was an amazing experience.
Okay, how tough was that for you? As you said, you know, you're a dog and motherfucker. Mm-hmm. How tough was that for you when, you know, you want to do well and you're in this ancestral home of Pinot Noir and everyone's lapping you with the grape picking?
I just had to suck it up.
Yeah.
Over the course of the 10 days, I got to know all the little French grandmothers and everybody else who picked. It's such a storied vineyard that, well, there's actually six of them or seven, but it's so storied that doctors and like lawyers take their summer vacation and harvest. So I think they come back year after year. May I share with you my favorite DRC story?
Yes, of course. My God, I'd be angry at you if you didn't.
So I lived on the property, and we would have a sort of a lunch and a dinner there. All the pickers who were living or camping around would do it. Some of the people who lived around the villages would go home for lunch or dinner. But anyways, so there's maybe 50 people in a mess hall and very Savour magazine-like family-style meals. And we had one Durex glass, and they would serve us our water, our wine, and our coffee out of this one Durex glass. And we would have what are known in the business as shiners. So these bottles that would just get dropped on the table, no label, no cork, no nothing. And as soon as you finished one bottle, you just raise the bottle and someone would bring another bottle. I didn't really think much about it, and we were drinking it. It was nice. And at the end of the 10 days, they allowed me to take home a couple of these bottles. And after a couple of weeks, I thought, I'm going to open one of these. And I opened it and poured it into a conventional wine glass, like a Riedel, you know, whatever. And I just stopped in my tracks and I went, oh my God, this is like when you haven't just come out of the field and you're like, your thighs are burning and you're sweating and all that. When you actually focus on the wine, it was totally incredible. The wine I was drinking, a bottomless bottle of at lunch and dinner. And then I did the math and I figured out that in Bordeaux, every winery has a second label. So if the juice doesn't make the first label, they'll put it into the second label. Mm-hmm. In Burgundy, there is no such thing as a second label. So wineries sell off their juice to other wineries if they have extra juice that doesn't make the grade, right? But if you're DRC, you can't sell your juice to anybody, because then they'd run around saying our wine's made with DRC. So what do? They make a cuvée, they bottle it in these shiners, and year round they drink this. So I was drinking DRC cuvée for lunch and dinner for 10 days. Out of a Durex water glass.
Oh my God. I can't even imagine, like, would you, your lunch, the value of the lunch wine you drank could, like, that's someone's, you know, that's a monthly mortgage payment or something.
Yeah. That's crazy. It was amazing. I've never, and just for the record, I've never actually had that theory confirmed, but I can guarantee that that's the case.
Oh my God. No. See, we only have so much time. I want to ask you like so many more DRC questions. But do you have, what were you, and maybe you have more now than you did when you wrote your first book, some of your favorite food wine pairings? Is there any that that come to mind? And I always tell people, the one general rule, if you love the food and if you love the wine, that's usually going to be a great pairing, unless it's a 15% Syrah with an oyster bar.
But sure.
In general, is there some food pairing with wine?
Sure. Well, it's funny how wine evolves. Your taste for wine evolves. Like my first wine ever was a Gamay Beaujolais. Like I started with the soft, easy wines,
yeah.
Right? Now I tend to drink a lot of California wines. And I have more of an appreciation for the funk. There's a bacterial effect that I'm sure you're very familiar with called Brettanomyces, aka Brett.
Yep.
A lot of people taste that, and it smells like a wet Band-Aid, a wet cloth Band-Aid from our youth. A lot of people smell that, and if there's a lot of that funk, it's like, ooh, either this wine's no good or I just don't like it or whatever. But I've learned that if you pair a wine, so we just had one a couple days ago that was Côte de Rhône, a big Hermitage Côte de Rhône, with a ton of Brett. But if you get a good fatty steak, like a rich steak, that funk and the fatness and richness of the steak work together so beautifully, and kind of the fatness of the steak tones down the funk. The funk brings out just these beautiful qualities from the meat. And so that's one of my very favorite pairings.
Does California wine get a bad rep? Because I know in the wine world, I was talking to the winemaker of Black Stallion a little while ago about this, that there is a snobbiness, there is a hesitation, there's a California cab, that's just going to be a bunch of sugar or chemicals and it's just going to be a big fruit bomb. And I'm not a big fan of Napa cab. That's like if they try to tell you this $20 Cabernet Sauvignon, this is from Napa grapes. I'm like, well, it probably isn't. And if it is, it's from the worst areas, strictly because you can't make it for $20. It's just economically, that's not viable. So I get how people can get turned off of it. But I'm wondering, just all the circles you travel in, is there a negative perception sometimes about California wines?
I'm in California drinking a lot of, like most of what I drink is California wines because I do some trading with wineries for cooking events. No, I think first of all, I think your palate always acclimatizes. When I'm here in Canada, and especially if I was here for like a whole summer working on a show, my palate quickly acclimatizes to Canadian whites, you know, Ontario whites, some of the reds. And in California, my palate has acclimatized to the bigger Napa reds and some of the other reds and varietals as well. And to the point where I almost crave that profile. And there are some damn fine wines that are made and some that have aged beautifully too. So no, to me, it's almost the kind of question that I'd never stop to think about because I don't really, I mean, I'm sure you go, oh, big, you know, bomb this, bomb that. But sometimes they're just really pleasing to drink.
Oh, God, yeah. No, absolutely. Actually, you know what? I've never even thought about that concept of your palate gets acclimatized to where you are in terms of the wines. If you're in Germany, you might be afraid of residual sugar in your white wine. And then a week in Germany, you're like, these Rieslings are incredible.
Oh, yeah.
I never even thought about that.
For surezies.
Let's hear talk about your new book. And by the way, I felt like I was on a talk show. Hey, tell me about your new book. But your latest book, Flavor Bomb, A Rogue Guide to Making Everything Taste Better. What are some of the tips to make everything tasting better?
Well, so this is all of my previous seven books or six books, I think this is my seventh, have always been a little bit eccentric and had eccentric, you know, surreal presentations and illustrations and things like that. This is a dead serious cookbook based on all the tricks and tips and hacks and techniques I've learned from eating my way around the world for the last 30 years. And the whole first half of the book is are all those tricks and tips and hacks. And they're all designed, if you read the first 80 pages of the book, you'll learn how to take whatever it is you make as your go-to Tuesday night dinner and up the ante on it by learning, and this is what I talk about throughout that whole first section, how to build layers of flavor and layers of texture. And that's really what differentiates a dish any dish you want to think of, lasagna or a pasta or even a hamburger. Like, let's take a hamburger, for example. You've got the meat, you've got the condiments, but the condiments, it could be, you know, you could just have ketchup, but if you want, you can make yourself a homemade aioli, you can make a homemade ketchup, how you choose to top it with maybe some crispy pickles, the bun and how you toast the bun and get some texture on it, on the bun too, so there's a bit of crunchiness and caramelization of the bread. Like, there's so many components to a hamburger, and if you look at each component and think to yourself, how can I make this the best that it can possibly be? And then eventually you get to one of these, the whole is, you know, greater than the sum of the parts. But by dealing with each of the parts and upping the ante on that, you can make the whole so much better. And so that's what this book is all about. Sure, there's recipes in the second half, and I'm very proud of them. And for example, there's a carbonara recipe that people tell me is their favorite carbonara recipe, nice. Whatever. But it's because I've dissected even a traditional classic dish and thought about the things you can do to up the ante. Or a puntanesca, for example. And here's just a simple example. With a puntanesca pasta, if you smash a couple of cloves of garlic and add them in at the very end, you've got your garlic that's been cooked, but then you get that brightness of the fresh garlic at the very end. Adding some breadcrumbs to a puntanesca, which isn't traditional, but that gives it, like fried breadcrumbs, gives it a nice crunch. Using the oil, there's anchovies in a puntanesca, but if you add the oil from the anchovy jar, that also is just going to add more big flavor. And so at every step of the way, I build flavor and I build texture. And that's what makes this Flavor Bomb, Flavor Bomb.
On the back of the book, I see a quote, before reading Flavor Bomb, all I could make was an omelet. That from Diplo, the DJ / producer. And what that made me think of is when I started the wine podcast, one of the things is, hey, I wanted to make wine more fun. People shouldn't be intimidated. You know, they go to the LCBO or whatever, giant or total wine, or they're at a restaurant and the wine menu looks like Gandalf's, you know, spell book. It's, you know, everyone's intimidated. And wine's supposed to be fun. Is it similar, do you think, with people getting into cooking? Do people get intimidated by cooking recipes, food, proper temperature? Like, is it similar to how it is with wine?
For sure. I mean, everybody gets intimidated about different things. I get intimidated about the thought of changing the oil in my car. Like, I wouldn't know where to start. You put a gun to my head at the tender age of 66, I wouldn't know where to start.
Do you have, I'm going to interrupt, do you have more corkscrews or actual tools in your home?
I only have one corkscrew. I was just gifted some crazy, like, bone covered cork. It's like, there's, you know, the double hinge one that you grab the neck of the bottle, mm-hmm. and then you push it in. And
yeah, push it. Yeah,
the double hinge.
Yeah, yeah,
that to me is the ultimate corkscrew. I don't need anything else.
Okay.
So,
but getting back to intimidation and
let's get back to Diplo, because there's actually a really good story there. Sure. The Diplo is an enormous DJ with like 6.5 million followers on Instagram. He moved across the street from me. Wouldn't even make eye contact for the first 2 years that he lived there, and then one day he rolls down his window. He starts talking to me, and I'm like, I can't figure out what has happened. Why does he want to talk to me? And it turns out that through another friend, I had had Moby for dinner, and Moby told Diplo, he said, oh, you live there? I had dinner across the street, and the guy's a pretty decent cook. So then Diplo invited himself, his name is Wes, invited himself to my house for dinner. And then during the whole pandemic, would like come over once a month. Mm-hmm. And that was sort of like, that was getting some, like figuring out how to get to somebody through food. And also, he was a sort of keen student of wine, too. So he wasn't a big wine drinker, but he really appreciated sort of tasting through wines.
I think you can get to anyone through food. It's one thing that, I mean, I can't think of a more common something that brings everyone together. I mean,
sure.
We all have a connection point when it comes to food, cooking, meals, something like that.
Yep. You sometimes have to, you know, food itself doesn't necessarily do it. You have to find out like what's the end point with like their nostalgic dish,
right,
or what part of the country or world they grew up in, something like that. So not everybody would say, for example, farm to table. Like that might, even though for me it would get me excited, but that's not everybody's cup of tea. But everybody definitely has some food memory or some favorite food, and there's always a way to get to people through food.
We all have our, when I was a kid, the tomato soup, grilled cheese combination when you came home from school for lunch. We'll end, oh, see, so many more things now. And I didn't even ask you about, like, you know, was Moby more of a Burgundy or Bordeaux person? But before we end...
By the way, Moby doesn't drink.
Oh, really?
No. He's a vegan who doesn't drink.
Right.
But an amazing guy. And by the way, so interesting. Like, a really interesting guy. And I was such a fan, of his music.
But that would be tough for...
But yeah, and the reason he came over was that I had developed this... it was a Thai corn soup that I developed for the book. I'm not the first person to make Thai corn soup, but I made it. And I used coconut milk as the base. And I realized, hey, this is vegan. This whole, like, I inadvertently created a very tasty soup with lots of dimension that was vegan. And I thought, hey, I could invite Moby for dinner. So being Hollywood, I had like 1 degree of separation from Moby, and that's how he ended up in my house.
And food, once again, the lure. I'd love to hear real quick just about the work that you did with Second Harvest. I think raising over a $250,000.
It's been the real honor of a lifetime to be an ambassador for them. I started just being invited to a couple of their events, and then I was shooting my show Surreal Gourmet and living down on a street called Cowan Avenue in Parkdale, and I was right across the street from the Parkdale Community Center, and I would see the truck arrive every morning and offload food that the chefs would come out to pick up, and I realized that they were getting deliveries from Second Harvest and that they would make whatever was being offloaded, they would take and make into meals for people in the community. And Second Harvest is an interesting model because they get all their food for free. They're really basically a trucking and logistics organization because they warehouse it over like a 2-day period and get it out to, I don't even know what the number is these days, but you know, hundreds of different organizations that distribute it. And so they're only limited, not by the amount of food, but by the infrastructure that they can create. And that's when money gets raised. It's basically for trucks and warehouse space and people to do all that work. And so it ends up costing about 50 cents a meal to feed somebody, which is incredible. And I think very efficient. And eventually I helped raise enough money through donating dinners at my house at their auctions to actually pay for a whole refrigerated truck that to this day drives around Toronto with my picture on the side of it,
really?
Which I'm very proud of.
Oh my God,
as egotistical
so cool.
as that may be, I think that's a fair trade of...
Several years' work. Screw being egotistical. You are taking your time and expertise, and you're doing it for a wonderful cause. And then the truck is out there doing good things. That's nice. Like, that must be a nice sort of life affirming moment whenever you see it.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And now I occasionally even do them for myself. I've created something called the Beechwood Canyon Chef's Table, and I sell dinners at my house for six people. So you can come to my house, and I do like the whole show in front of you and pair wines.
Do they bring the wines or is it your wines?
No, it's mostly my wines unless they want to bring something special of their own.
Right. Do you got a bottle at your home that you're eyeing that you can't wait to open, either to share with others, to have on your own? Do you have something that you've put away that you're like, oh, I can't wait to uncork this?
When I was picking grapes at DRC, not only did they give me two bottles of their house wine, but I did a thank you dinner for them, and Aubert de Villain gave me, he told his henchman who had originally told me, I spit on you, you'll never pick grapes here, to go downstairs, and they brought me a 74 Montrachet. They don't even sell their white, right? They make one white. They make six reds.
Wow.
Latache.
Yeah.
And so he gave me a 74 Montrachet, but that's long since consumed. And I have trophy wines. You know, at the end of the day, I think it's really not about the trophy wines, but I have a couple of sine qua nons that I've saved those for auction dinners and things. If I can up the ante and raise more money by saying, and I'm going to serve you a sine qua non, I will do so.
See, again, you're doing that for the right reason. My thought on trophy wines, I have no problem with trophy wines as long as you drink it for charity, but as long as you drink it and at a great moment. I hate the idea of someone has, I have a wine cellar of 40,000 bottles of wine. What are you going to drink? Well, no. What are you doing here? Like, at some point, you know, every bottle I have, my nicest bottle, I'm like, that's a birthday, that's an anniversary,
right?
Or that's a great Tuesday.
What is your trophy wine?
I have I've got some old Bordeaux's. I've got a couple, like a bunch of first and second growth old Bordeaux's, and some of them are just ones that I got the first time I was there back in 2015.
Sure, so they have personal represent personal memories.
40th birthday, girlfriend and I, you know, traveled around all over France, all over the wine regions, and so some of those bottles I look at, I'm like, oh yeah, That's where I was when I was 40. I can't wait to open that with my girlfriend. So that's a lot of it, what it is. So, and it's, yeah. So, I mean, that, to me, that's what wine's all about. It's about memories, about moments, and it's about elevating a moment with a nice bottle of wine.
Sure. You know, I interviewed Jason Priestley once. I'm playing your role and interviewing him, and he's a big wine guy.
Yep.
And I asked him what his trophy wine was, and his answer was really interesting. He had a bottle of, now I've forgotten the year. What was the year of the shot that was heard around the world?
Oh, 2000. Are we talking about basketball?
No.
I went to sports.
That, you know the movie that was made, Bottle Shock?
Oh, Bottle Shock. Yeah.
And so the shot that was heard around the world is when the Americans, it was in the early 70s. It might have been 74.
I think it was 76, and I should know that. Yeah, so the judgment, the Paris judgment.
Yes, Paris judgment. Yeah. So he had a bottle of the
Chateau Montelena?
Yes.
Yeah.
And so I thought that was really interesting because it wasn't so much that it was, you know, a first growth Bordeaux, but it had a place in American wine history, and I was always respectful of that answer and of him, and he's actually a great guy. And I've opened more than a few bottles with him in my day.
That's a perfect wine for a trophy wine, because you're right. You know the one I've always wanted to try, my sort of bucket list, just with a sense of history, I want to drink a wine that was made in France in 1945. Like the idea that they could make and release a wine right as the Second World War is coming to an end, that sense of history and gravitas, that sort of one.
Well, you know, that brings up an interesting point, which is that when I was at DRC and they took me downstairs into their vault where they have all the historical wines going back all the way to the beginning, there were a few years, like war years, where there were empty, you know, because they didn't make wine then.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, and they hide all the wines, and they would make these fake walls, and kids would throw spiders on them to create spider webs to make it look like this was just an old wall and not something that was built 6 weeks ago. Yeah, we really did bounce all over the place in terms of topics. Bob, tell, you know, just one more time, where can websites, and again, the book, Flavor Bomb, A Rogue Guide to Making Everything Taste Better. If people need more Bob Bloomer in their life, where do they go?
I'm not sure how many people are sitting there going, you know what I really need in my life right now?
10% more Bob.
So it's BOBBLUMER, and that's my Instagram. That's my website. I can give you my phone number if you want.
You know what? Probably not the best idea. You know.
I'm very easy to find and track down.
Bob, really appreciate it. This has been really cool. Shout out to Susan and everyone for helping to put this together. Thanks for doing the pod tonight.
Oh, no. Thank you for the interest in chatting.
Thanks, everyone, for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Remember, you can find me on Spotify, iTunes, Apple, and wherever quality podcasts are sold.
Thanks for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Happy hunting.